drive and ambitiousness are one of the key things I think any musician can try and cultivate. And I think if we try to learn this skill every day, others will see this and good things will come of it.
Herzlich willkommen zu Weites Feld, dem Podcast für klassische Musiker auf der Suche nach Inspiration und neuen Wegen. Mein Name ist Max Gärtner und ich treffe mich mit Musikschaffenden, die mit einer klassischen Ausbildung begonnen haben und unkonventionelle Wege gegangen sind, um ihre ganz eigene Idee einer Karriere im Musikbusiness zu leben. Gemeinsam versuchen wir herauszufinden, worauf es bei einer Karriere als Profimusiker ankommt, wie man als Freelancer die richtige Work-Life-Balance findet und sich selbst dabei immer treu bleibt. Herzlich willkommen zur aktuellen Folge von Weites Feld, der Podcast. Vor kurzem sind die Stockhausen-Tage in Kürten zu Ende gegangen und da habe ich die Gelegenheit ergriffen und den Trompeter David Aguila interviewt, der extra aus den USA angereist ist, um an den Kursen teilzunehmen und jetzt noch ein bisschen Recherche betreibt und im Archiv von Stockhausen für seine Dissertation forscht. David hat in New York an der Eastman School of Music sein Trompetenstudium begonnen und ist dann nach Kalifornien zum California Arts Institute gewechselt. Er hat ursprünglich eher klassische Ausrichtung gehabt und hat mal gedacht, dass er vielleicht Orchestermusiker werden könnte, hat sich aber dann anders orientiert und arbeitet seither im Bereich zeitgenössische Musik. Durch Zufall und durch seinen Mitbewohner im Studium ist er zur Komposition gekommen und hat seitdem einige Stücke geschrieben, die sich auch intensiv mit elektroakustischer Musik und mit elektronischen Effekten und Instrumenten beschäftigen. Was er zur aktuellen Debatte über Artistic Research denkt und wie sich künstlerische Forschung in den USA gestaltet, wieso er extra nach Deutschland reist, um an den Stockhausen-Kursen teilzunehmen und wie es dazu kam, dass er in Jay Leno's Tonight Show Trompete gespielt und gleichzeitig den Rubik's Cube gelöst hat, das erzählt er uns im Interview. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören. Hi, David. Nice to meet you.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks. You are at the Stockhausen house at the moment, or did I get right with your Instagram stories?
Well, I've been there. I've been doing research. I'm currently in Curtin, but yeah, I'm in the hub of Stockhausen land, I suppose.
I see. So maybe you can tell something. What are you doing there? There was the courses, right?
Yeah, there were a few weeks ago, there was the Stockhausen courses, but right now I'm doing research on some pieces from the 60s and 70s that are of a graphic notation and somewhat improvised. So it's actually a very unique period in Stockhausen's repertoire of music where there's openness to it.
And why is this especially so interesting for your work?
The most interesting aspect about it is it's combining all the paths that I've been going down into a central hub of information where, well, I'm a trumpet player and I am a composer, an electronic musician and composer, and this music particularly interests me to develop new ways of improvisation and in ways that I think we as musicians kind of already talk about, but also different ways of thinking about this. Because for me, I didn't come from a jazz background. I was an orchestral player and I never really did improv until free improvisation. And now this music is, I guess you could say, a structured improv.
Okay, I see. And many of your pieces, we will surely talk about that bit later, your composing stuff, are basically based on this graphic idea, right?
Yeah, graphics and text. So I try to always give a visual cue in some way for the either the performer or even the audience.
And just before you got to the Stockhausen courses, you have been to another course or something like that. Is that right?
Right after, actually, immediately after. Yeah, I was in Cologne doing Ensemble Musik Fabrik's Brass Academy.
Ah, okay. And what was this about? Basically on experimental playing techniques, or what was it?
Experimental and contemporary brass. And it was with the four brass players of Musik Fabrik, Marco Blau, Christy Chapman, Melvin Poor, and Bruce Collings. And they really just immersed everyone in contemporary and experimental brass music and techniques.
It's very interesting because you are coming from Florida, right?
Well, yes, all the
way
from Florida.
So it's quite a long way to travel. And I find very interesting, is it like you were planning to, I mean, how did you get to know about these courses, you know? Is it like long-term planning, you wanted to go to Germany to maybe research also in Stockhausen, or was it more by random?
No, definitely not by random. A few years ago, I was accepted into this program in The Hague called Auslicht. And I wasn't able to go at the time, but I kept up my studies of Stockhausen. And I really thought, okay, even if I'm not there, this music has something to teach me. And so I kept learning and kept studying. And then I was accepted into a doctoral program in San Diego. And immediately, I knew that the courses would be coming up again, and that I wanted to go and I wanted to learn more. And we had to do a project about research, and so I decided to focus on these pieces of this notation, and I used that assignment for my research proposal to get funding to come to Europe this summer.
And so at the moment you are writing your doctoral thesis, or is it already finished? No,
I'm still in the beginning stages. I'm now collecting information. I just finished my first year in San Diego in the doctorate program, and now that I've got this focus and got all this information, I'm now trying to think about how these questions that I've asked can be used for qualifying exams and a dissertation down the line. I know that they will be useful, but now it becomes taking everything, because of course there's a big wealth of knowledge, and now condensing it and focusing even more about what I can ask myself about this music and brass and where it can lead me.
So you're kind of researching in the field of artistic research, is that right?
Yeah, performance practice.
And this, at the moment, this is like a really big deal here in Europe. I'm sure it is also in the States, but the thing is, here in Germany especially, at the moment there's a huge discussion about, you know, if artistic research, or maybe in generally, if the arts, you know, should be like researching like a scientific way, and if this is maybe dangerous for the scientists, and or if it, you know, if it the other side, if this is maybe dangerous for the arts because it comes too theoretically and something like this. So it would be very interesting, because in a few weeks I will head to Detmold, to the University of Music, and give a talk on my artistic research, because I'm currently also in the middle of my PhD thesis.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. How was your entrance idea to the work? What methods maybe do you use for your research? And how is the product? Is it only a written book, or is it also a performance, or how you work on this?
Yeah. Well, I foresee for this at least three aspects. The first being the research and the theory, but presenting it in a way that is a guide for performers. So everything that I've taken from, you know, work number 12 to work number 31, condensing this information so that way we as performers can take it and not have to study all of Stockhausen's work, but if we want to play this music, but really condense it into a form that is accessible to musicians. Because I think a lot of people, including myself prior to all this, I was frightened of entering this world because of how rich it was and how demanding it was. But the more I actually realize this is there's a lot that's given to us, but the part of it is it's up to us as the performers to take the initiative to find and research all of this just to play one piece of music. So I think a guide is what all of this research is going towards. The other aspect of it, the second one is, of course, a performance of all of this work. And hopefully I can perform it with the same facilities that Stockhausen had imagined for these works, which was this dome of a building with a transparent sound floor and 50 speakers that could project sound in every direction. And of course, you know, a recording would be great. I'm hoping to do this in May in San Diego to record the solo, the duo, the trio, and the quartet version of these graphic works. And of course, the final thing would be to give a lecture, to actually have a talk and interact with people who may not be may not know this music, and introduce them to it and make it accessible and have it be so future musicians, when they decide, oh, that they want to do Stockhausen's music, or if they're coming from an idea of wanting to learn to improvise, but not in a sense of tonal jazz, if we're going to say that that's one aspect, and not necessarily free improvisation, which is on the other side of the things, but maybe a structured improv that gives information that is new, but also information that we as musicians already talk about. And I think the easiest way, if I can just summarize it from one of the performers, Michael Vetter, we as musicians talk about, oh, this was good, but can I get a little bit more, right? Oh, this was a little too much, let's have a little less. And so in Stockhausen's language for these pieces, he gives you a plus sign or a minus sign, which then we can add to a parameter of the music itself. And so these are my main three goals for all of this research pushing forward.
And how is it working in the States if you want to get into such a program? Did you have to write, abstract of your work, or to come somewhere to say, hey, I want to do this and that?
Yeah, it was absolutely an application process for the school to say what I was interested in and where I'm coming from and my goals. And also giving the institution work that I had previously done in writing. And so that was the application process to enter the school. But now that I'm in the institution and preparing for preparing all this information for what they call as qualifications, which is pre-dissertation motion. I'm preparing these questions that I will possibly receive from my faculty mentors, who will pick attributes of my research and then ask me a question, and then I'll, again, have to write about it in order to pass the qualification and then begin my dissertation process.
Ah, I see. So they're like going with you through the first part of your work, and they're like checking maybe if you are able to get in the dissertation process at all. So it's not like you're standing in front of this huge mountain of work and everybody says like, okay, see you in 3 years. And
yeah. No, none of them are like that. I feel very fortunate that I have faculty mentors who I've met with every week, and my private teacher who I've been just meeting with to figure all of this out. And then also in Europe, I've been lucky to be in contact with the people in the Stockhausen Foundation, Katinka and Susie, mm-hmm. and the archivalist Maria, to help feed me more information and prepare myself for what is now the end of my second day of research here in Curtin.
Yeah. And you said you had, before you could start your dissertation process, you had to send them some of your recent writings. Is it you mean the pieces you composed, or did you write something about music before that?
I wrote something about music. And for this, it was actually performance practice-based writing. And so the two things I had written about were a production that I had done with an arts collective I started in Los Angeles. We produced the first ever live performance of Kagel's radio piece, Na und Fern, which is for trumpet, quartet, and electronics. And what I wrote about on that paper was the process of reconstructing the electronics and working with the trumpet quartet in order to do a live performance. And that was just an extensive process that took many, many, many weeks to do for that performance. And the other paper that I submitted was actually nothing to do with trumpet as well, and mostly dealt with electronics, was a performance practice of, well, I guess for lack of a better term, sound projection. And in this case, what I was talking about was live processing musicians through laptop and MIDI controllers and learning to perform without making a sound. Because in those instances, I was taking an input from a trumpet player or an oboe player and processing this to give more texture or depth to the performance, but that required very intense listening skills on my part of what input I was receiving, and also the gesture of the musician and making sure that I complimented it, or if I wasn't too keen on it, making sure that I could destroy it with intent, but also knowing how to really create a performance practice for this, because I had been searching for people online and papers of those who had done this before, and I really hadn't found anything. So I felt like it was up to me to notate this or write it down and give a guide for people who are maybe interested in doing this in the future.
And how did you get into this whole field? I mean, it seems like it's a hard process to write about music first time, you know? It's like, how do I write about this? Maybe was it like you read works of other people to get into it, or you just started writing what was on your mind? Or was it like a thing like you read a book about how to write about music? Or, you know, it's very interesting because many people have or don't know really how to start first, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I knew how to start. I think my education gave me some idea of how to be an academic writer. But I think the biggest influence that was had on me was attending the Stockhausen courses in 2017. And there was a theme for that course, and there's a theme for all the courses, and that one was learning to ask why. And so my questions of why became, well, why is Stockhausen such a prolific composer? Why am I writing not as good as I could? And I think I was very fortunate to be introduced at this time to Stockhausen, because he is very prolific in his documentation and very precise in how he documents. And I became very manic in my study of his work. But in doing so, I learned to, in just watching and reading his work, and then going down the rabbit hole of, oh, well, this person was influenced by Stockhausen, and now I'm going to read all of their work, and really learning from those who inspired me, which was the theme of the course this year, learning who inspires. So through reading all of these academics or performers' work of just purely written, I learned what I could do to be a better writer. And so when it came to the process of writing, I knew what I wanted to write, and I made bullet points for myself of the things that I wanted to address. And then it became just the slow process that I guess we as musicians call practice, right? Of practicing every day and writing these papers or writing these topics. And I came up with my own practice for writing and how I go about this, because I think just as we all practice our instrument in a unique way, I learned to do this, my practice of writing in this way. And I then pass this on to my students in San Diego of what I call like puzzling paragraphs together. If information doesn't seem like it doesn't fit, instead of deleting the sentence, make it a new paragraph, even if it's one sentence. And maybe down the line in your work, you will realize where this sentence belongs, even if it didn't belong at the top or in the middle or wherever. It somehow sticks in your mind that it can fit into what you're actually talking about. It just may not be the right time for it to be introduced. And it was just a long process. I think also there was an aspect of time constraint, because the application for San Diego was coming up very soon and I had to write two papers really, really quick. But I just diligently wrote, and I had a lot of support from friends and mentors who I was able to send this to and ask them for their input if things did or did not make sense. And, you know, there was a lot of self-drive to succeed, but also a lot of critical thinking about what I was writing and how it was presented. But again, I think that comes from the experience I had from taking that course and then going down that rabbit hole of exploration.
And when you're into writing, I mean, you start your day and you have to write some essays for maybe an application or something else, or for your PhD at the moment. Is there some special way you do it? I mean, I was talking recently to a colleague that's also writing his dissertation at the moment, and he was like, I'm writing, you know, 500 words every day, and that's my thing, and then I will be done with my work in 3 months, you know? Or is it like, it's really strange, but every guy has his own, you know, way to do something. But how is it with you? Is it like you sit down and you write until you don't know what to write next? Or is it like, you know, you have a special way to do it?
I think there's a few aspects. The first is I try to plan as much as ahead as I can and just make bullet points of things that I should be addressing in my paper. So that way I don't stray too far. Because for me, I have a habit of... even in normal conversation, not even in my writing, I talk too much. I get excited. I love to talk. And
perfect thing for the podcast, by the way.
Of course, absolutely. So that's actually the first thing that I tried to do, is make a list, a very short list of questions that I should be addressing. And from there, the research comes, and then I don't try to force it. This 500 words a day or 500 whatever, I couldn't do this. I would freak out. This would give me a type of tension or anxiety to fulfill something with an intent of discovery. Because at this point, I'm still discovering exactly what information I need to hone in on. And so I make these bullet points, and then I keep a notebook. And this notebook is actually a handwritten notebook. I find it very useful to write notes. And I take a page out of like one of my mentors' concepts of just observing. So if I am walking down the street and I have an observation of, oh, this is a great idea for what I should be writing about, I have my notebook with me and I write these points down. the idea or even where I am when I have the idea. And when it comes to then actually writing down or going back to discover this idea more fully, it's there. And I'm not necessarily forcing it because I may not want to stop in the middle of my walk or if I'm eating lunch to write a whole big chunk of paper. But also if I try to force this in the same time to get this idea rolling when I'm not in that headspace of being focused to write, then I lose it. I lose the focus or I put too much pressure on myself. Whereas if I set aside a time every day, and this is what I usually do, I set aside a time and I know that in this time, just as I would practice my instrument, I will write. And I focus in on this and I go to my notebook. I go to my notes that are either in photos or in whatever. And I look at this and I know exactly what I have to do. And then it becomes a very focused moment of writing. And then it becomes more fluid. It becomes much easier for me to articulate my thoughts, my ideas, and my goals in my writing. And usually I'll just write. I'll blab as much information as I can. And then I do what I told my students. I puzzle this information together. At the next, you know, the next session for writing, I'll read what I've written. Right. And then I'll say, this is good information. This is very cohesive. This doesn't work. Let me make this a new paragraph and maybe push it to the bottom. It's good information. It's good writing. Or maybe it's not good writing, but the content is there or the intent is there. And then I sculpt it just as we would sculpt a phrase to make it musical to really fit the character of the writing or this paragraph. Or however it needs to fit. But I try not to throw away any information. And if it doesn't actually work, well, then it doesn't work, you know. But for me, this is the easiest way to achieve my goals. And then when it comes to actually fully writing the paper or the whatever I need to do, it's easy.
I surely want to go back to the thing that you said, that your education partly helps you today, that you're able to write about music. How is very interesting to see maybe how, where you started from with your musical education, maybe also to get there where you are today in your PhD program and in Kürten now with the Stockhausen House. And it's so interesting, you know, where somebody started off that is now heading to this projects or plans. What was your first, I mean, how did you start with the music and where was your, how did that career start?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to play trumpet. And the moment I picked it up, I knew that this was the path. I think that's a very rare case, but I felt it. And so throughout my grade school studies, I wanted to be an orchestral musician, which then led me to apply and get a degree from the Eastman School of Music in New York. And I was studying orchestra music, wanting to be an orchestral musician. And it's a very conservatory style school. There was lots of reading and lots of theory and all the things that you would expect from a very demanding conservatory style approach of teaching. However, halfway through my time at Eastman, I realized that I need to make money in order to support my passion for music. And it became very clear one day when I was researching that there were, I think, 4 jobs teaching and performing trumpet. And there were 26 people in my trumpet studio, just in Eastman at the time. So I knew that it was going to be nearly impossible for me to try to go down this path and successfully support myself as an orchestral musician. While this happened, I had some not so good experiences in orchestra, and that led me actually to the path that I'm on now of contemporary and experimental music. I told my teacher, I told Professor Thompson, please don't put me in orchestra anymore. I want to be in the contemporary music ensemble. I really want to explore this.
And what did he say to that?
He said, of course.
Okay.
He was very supportive.
That's great. But because, you know, I mean, often the orchestral teacher guys are not too happy to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the best qualities about Jim. He cares for all of his students. And when they ask for something, he knows that they're asking because they want to get more out of it.
Yeah.
And so he put me only in the contemporary music ensemble for the remainder of my time at Eastman. I was in the wind ensemble and contemporary music ensemble, no more orchestra. And it was exhilarating. I could play. I had many, many notes. It was the most difficult music I had ever played. And it seemed like, unlike wind ensemble, there was a career for this. Now, while all of this was going on in my trumpet studies, I was discovering composition through my theory homework, because of course, when you're in school and you have theory, they ask you to write a composition. And I found that I loved this. And I was very fortunate to be living with a composer for most of my time at Eastman. And so we would always have very deep conversations about composition, or we would write music and we would talk about this, and he would write trumpet music, and I was his trumpet player. So of course I would get to premiere all of his trumpet works. So this actually led me down the path of composition as well, and even to take lessons while at Eastman. In fact, my composition teacher is now my colleague at UCSD. He's also getting his PhD there. So it's actually a very small world and very cool. And also with my friend who is a composer, we were discovering electronics. So these became the three interests which completely developed until the end of my career at Eastman. And I became just fascinated with it.
And this all until this second in the interview happened during your bachelor studies, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Crazy much things going on in your first semesters then.
Well, this was actually in the end of my degree there.
I see.
Yeah. So I think the last 2 years was when this awakening truly started to happen.
And have your first compositions also been developed in this time?
No. So I did have a few compositions. My composition teacher, Harris, he had students and he asked all of us to compose and then put on a concert. So my first compositions, although they may not be great compositions, my first compositions developed here, and I began to really explore my style of writing. And it became apparent that, at least for my composition, it was always stemming from concept. Like, as if you could say, oh, this is a conceptual piece of art, this is a conceptual piece of music. It's the concept that is driving it. Which, when I began to look for master's programs, is when this actually really took off. Because I started looking at schools that were not traditional, so the complete antithesis of Eastman, and had electronics and had composition and trumpet playing in a way that I had never done before and that I wanted to explore. And I was fortunate that one of my good friends, Ted Taforo, was at the California Institute of the Arts, and I gave him a call, and then he said, you should come and visit. I came and visited, and that was it. I knew that this was the place. And during my time at CalArts, I cultivated these three goals. And I feel very lucky to have been made this path for myself, or made this trajectory, because I think it's very easy to be exposed to so much while you're in a place like CalArts and get distracted. But I was very headstrong in knowing that these were the things I wanted to do, and it was there that these compositions and this style truly developed.
And your compositions often or mostly deal also with some electronic stuff. And you told me that you got into these electronic things during your Eastman time with your colleague that you lived together. How was this? How have your first steps been in the electronic field of music? I mean, it's very interesting. What maybe was your first thing to do with that?
I just remember us just hanging out and working in Reason at the time. And I had no idea what I was doing, but the sounds that I was hearing and the type of control that my roommate and I had over these sounds was just incredible. And I think we more let our musical intuition drive us. And I had no idea what the fader or the knob or the button did at the time. And I wouldn't even been able to tell you. I would have had to describe it as like, oh, it's making a whoop, whoop, whoop sound, or it's going, yeah. And, but it fascinated me with one key, I could have as much control over the sound as a full orchestra. And this was just an intriguing moment and a discovery moment for myself. Of what electronics could do. And so when I went to CalArts is when I began my true formal studies of electronics.
After having found out what you really wanted to do in the field of music, and you went all this long way until to the you came to the CalArts, after that, when did your, let's say, professional career as a musician start? If we talk about professional in case of, you know, earning some money with it, how did your first jobs look like, or how did this work, especially the first steps out of the school into the field of professional money earning musician, you know?
I had no clue how to do this. I had some inclination of how it worked, but it was a different playing field. I had just moved to Los Angeles for my master's at CalArts, and now this my third year. I was fortunate to have gotten a job at CalArts, but I was working in the library. So I was playing gigs every so often and teaching, but I wasn't supporting myself through what we could say the music industry. And it became very difficult. So with that job in particular, because it was a night job, and I, of course, as a musician, when does everyone have time to rehearse? In the evening. When are most of the concerts? In the evening. When did I work? In the evening. So I realized that although this is a good job, it's not the right job for as a musician. And I began to seek other avenues to be in the music industry and support myself to do my artistic work. And that process took 2 years. It was 2 years before I really began to support myself as a musician. And when it finally reached a point, I would say that I was working in the music industry, and Los Angeles is a very unique city because I think it has the movie industry and the recording industry, and there's venues for classical and Baroque and contemporary and experimental music and pop music, and everyone is looking for a musician at some point. One day I got called to do a commercial for an app and just to play trumpet. And okay, that I made a few hundred dollars just doing this commercial. But when it came down to it, the culmination of all of this work wound up being that I worked at Los Angeles Opera, and it was a terrific job. It had nothing to do with music formally in my job. I was doing data entry, which was just a skill that I guess I was good at and enjoyed. I like numbers and I like puzzles. There's a famous video of me doing the Rubik's Cube and playing trumpet.
That question is coming with further. You have to tell something about this.
And so I was doing this job at LA Opera and also attending the opera and getting to meet all the other musicians there and seeing what other connections the opera had to the musical community. I was then teaching trumpet lessons. And then I was also an administrator in a music facility that offered lessons. So I was just always surrounded by music. But in the evenings is when my true musical focus could come into play. And I think that was the best thing about working these jobs is they were jobs in the music industry that helped support my path. So when it came to actually creating my music or my compositions or doing projects, it felt very special. I was afforded, now after all the day's work, I could come home and do music. And I very much was like, yes, I've done it, you know? And I started an arts collective with two of my friends, and we did all of these productions, including this one of Coggle's Na Un Fern. And this was actually a driving force for me. This was one of the moments after finally learning to support myself in the music industry, to support my art and my practice. This was the next thing that was taking off. And we did an experimental music salon in our house. We did a live scoring of a silent film with a noise band, doing Carl Theodor Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc to noise music. We did this Coggle piece, and we did a sound installation at Burning Man. And this is when everything started to come into focus that, the concerts that we're doing, we need to have contracts. The grants that we are writing, we need to be good writers. We need to have skills outside of just becoming good performers in order to be good entrepreneurs as for musicians. And this is when it clicked, where, yes, I've become a trumpet player who has achieved a lot, but now my skills needed to be cultivated in these areas of learning to write grants, learning to do contracts, learning to do budget spreadsheets. And when I came to Los Angeles after all of the Ausleicht things had not happened, I was the busiest musician I had ever been. I was going to concerts, I was writing compositions, I was doing recording, producing, sound engineering, electronics, you name it. I was supporting myself purely as a musician when I came back. But I think it was all of those experiences that were able to slowly grow. And again, how I was talking about planning my writing in advance, this was slowly building up after all of these years. And it was at that moment, for me at least, where here I am in the world after so many years of school and trying that I became successful. And I think I was able to become successful more so because of these experiences. And I think more than anything, learning from all of these failures that I had in all of these ventures. Of course, there were successes, but the failures were the ones that taught me the most.
And
quite a long story, but
no, it's great. And how is it like your days today are organized? I mean, you were telling of a part of your life where you worked over the day, and then you performed, and then you practiced, and then you rehearsed, and then you have become the busiest musician you have ever been, and now you're a researcher also, and a composer and a performer. How is it like you get your whole day or week or maybe year organized so you have the chance to don't forget one of those important things, you know, because of course you can't stop practicing for a year because you need to write, or, you know, how do you get this stuff organized?
I write a list. I'm very much a list person. I write a list in handwriting and I stick it on my wall.
Okay.
And whether that list is for a piece of music or a project, it's there. And it's something that I see every day when I wake up. And I know that I have things that I must achieve on this list. So then it becomes, in the morning, I keep a consistent routine, which is I wake up, I have my coffee. If I can have my coffee outside, I do this. And then I practice. And then I really begin my research part of the day and or my classes for the day. And I do this as a full day practice where it becomes a routine of these cycles. And sometimes the cycle may not be the same as yesterday. Sometimes it may, but I'm always keeping in mind what needs to be achieved on this list. And so in keeping this schedule and this consistent cycle, I'm actually able to achieve this, because if not, I would, you know, totally eat lunch for 4 hours and then take a nap and then be like, oh, well, I should just go home, you know, because that's the easy thing to do. But in doing it this way, I hold myself accountable. And I had a very a big epiphany last year that after a different set of courses for trumpet, my grandmother asked me, just passing, oh, you practice so much. Why do you practice so much? And I said, without thinking, this is my job. And then I actually started to think about, yes, this is my job. And if this is my job, well, if I was in any other job, let's say my job would be 8 hours. So if I need to work as a musician for 8 hours, how do I make that time? Well, as a trumpet player, you can only practice so many hours. So let's say that I practice 3 hours a day. So then that leaves 5 hours open. And then I think, well, I could research, or I can study some music, or I compose. And then it becomes looking at the calendar of what is coming up next. If I have a performance, then the music is the most important thing. If I have to write a composition, that is the most important thing. And I look at these lists, these calendars, and my cycle, and I adjust it for what needs to get done, whether it's most immediate, or again, if I have those passing moments where I observe and a thought comes that is useful for something 6 months down the line, I can write it down and come back to it 6 months from now when it actually can be used, rather than trying to stress out about this information right in the moment when it's actually not the most important.
That's an interesting thought at the end, especially this not getting too stressed about thoughts, maybe things that have to be done in a few months or something. How is it like not becoming crazy during all these parallel projects? Oh, yeah, you got crazy. Okay, I see.
Yeah, no. I definitely think that you go crazy and you lose a lot of sleep. That Coggle concert, for instance, I think the week leading up to it, I don't think I slept much at all. But it... I think it becomes, there are two options. You can either focus and complete the work, or you can freak yourself out and probably not get anything else, not much done until the very end, and the quality may suffer. So I made a very clear distinction a few years ago not to worry and to just focus on the present and try to achieve this work at the caliber that I've set for myself. I have a standard for myself that I always try to increase, and I just try to chip away every day like a sculptor. That's the best example I can give.
So many great things to learn from you, from your work. It's really crazy. How did all this lead you to play trumpet while you're playing with the Rubik's Cube in the Jay Leno show? Which is a great thing, right? The Jay Leno show?
Oh, fantastic. Oh, yeah. No,
it's a huge thing in the TV, is it?
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's like the evening event, you know, at that hour is like the Tonight Show. During grade school, I had attended this summer camp, which was in Michigan. So if you have students who are listening and want to get a good experience with music and arts, Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, can only recommend it like 100% of the time. And there was this French cellist who could solve the Rubik's Cube. And I was just so impressed. And Francois showed me just the basics of this. And I took this home, and of course I became manic, as I do, with this, and I learned how to solve it. And then I learned to solve it with one hand, right? Because two hands is
because you can, of
right,
course.
It's too easy with two hands. What's the next hardest thing? One hand, or with your feet, or blindfolded, or however you do this. So one day, my band director said, "I bet you cannot do this while playing the trumpet." And I said, "I bet I can." So we went to the practice room, and I came out, and then I said, "Watch this." And I did it for him.
And he freaked out.
Of course he freaked out. Who does this? So there was then, a few weeks or months later, there was this benefit concert for a student who was ill, or I can't quite remember at this moment. And I did this performance, and I made a recording on video of myself. And then my mother and I sent it to The Tonight Show. And then weeks later, we received a call asking me to be on. And that process actually took a few years to happen because of course, I was in school and I was performing, and the dates they wanted me to come, of course, were during concerts. And it was this big, I hope this happens moment type of situation.
Yeah.
But it did. And they flew me to Los Angeles, and it was my first time there. And I got to meet Jay, and I got to meet the band and see this studio and experience, have a very typical Los Angeles time there. And it was very positive. It was very positive because I was exposed to a different culture than the East Coast, because I think the East Coast and the West Coast are very different in their musical approaches. And also see this side of the music industry, and I don't know. I just felt very fortunate to do something that was two things that I loved doing and get to share it.
And what maybe has come after this? I mean, it was a huge publicity that saw you performing this crazy stuff. Have some jobs maybe come out of this show? Or connections, or you know what I mean?
Connections, yes. Jobs, not so much, because it becomes, I think it became, at least for me, a gimmick, right? Where, oh, he's going to play and solve this. It becomes like, you know, well, what piece can he do next? And it becomes a very repetitive process of this. So I actually, after that, I wound up putting down the Rubik's Cube because it became like a, I felt like I was performing for people who were just asking me down the street, and there was no benefit or reward other than for the person asking.
Right? Yeah.
The true benefit was actually getting into CalArts. Ed Carroll, who's the trumpet teacher at CalArts, saw this video. And when I was doing my research on CalArts and sending emails, I emailed Ed, and Ed had already known me, had already knew me from this
from this video.
From this video.
And so, that's funny.
So it became not a question for Ed. He was, of course, wanting me as his student because he was interested in how my brain works and knew that the way that I was practicing my arts, whether it was trumpet or Rubik's Cube or exercising my brain, CalArts would be a proper place for me to continue exploring these avenues of my brain and music. That was the true benefit of that, of doing the Tonight Show, was being able to get to CalArts.
That's an absolute amazing story. Thank you, David, so much to giving some information about your brain works in this podcast and about all your everyday works. When you're back, I mean, when are you heading back to the States? Are you staying for a long time in Curtin now?
So my research ends on the 22nd, so in just a few days. And then I return to Cologne for a week and just kind of practice and make preparations. I'm hoping that I can return to Europe for more research come the new year and spend a bit more time here and continue down this route of finding work that is notated improvisation or notated graphic improvisation. But I return officially on September the 1st to the States. And then at the end of that month, I begin my studies again at UCSD. And we'll see what happens.
So during your research time in Curtin, you're also practicing stuff for upcoming projects or concerts, or you're writing also?
A little bit of both. I have my first recital that I'm planning in maybe the fall. I'm still trying to solidify a date of works by composers who are well known. Of course, there'll be a Stockhausen piece of this music that I'm researching. There'll be a Globokar piece. There'll be a piece by Marc-André. One of my colleagues at UCSD is writing a piece for me. I'm very lucky. And I'll be also writing a piece and doing a conduction, which is another set of improvisation ventures which I've been exploring deeply over the past year.
Okay, so you are not getting out of new projects. That's good to hear. It's always something that's on your list at the wall.
Always.
And
always
needs to be checked. At the end of every podcast, David, I'm asking every guest a few questions.
Of course.
So here they are coming. First question is there something special that you are learning at the moment or practicing? I mean, Rubik's Cube, you know, is checked. So what's next?
Oh, yeah, of course. Drive and ambitiousness are one of the key things I think any musician can try and cultivate. And I think if we try to learn this skill every day, others will see this and good things will come of it.
What do you read at the moment? Besides the Stockhausen stuff, of course.
I'm reading two things right now. The first is this book by Kandinsky, Point to Line to Plane. My composition teacher at CalArts, Vinny Golia, recommended it, so I'm rereading it now after a few years off. And the second book I'm reading at the moment is Luciano Cessa's book on Luigi Rossolo, who did the Intoner Amore devices and wrote the Futurist Intoner's Manifesto.
Okay. The podcast is hosted on every possible platform where you can listen to podcasts, also YouTube channel, et cetera, but I did a playlist on Spotify that is something like going parallel to the podcast, and every guest is invited to add one or more songs to the playlist. Spontaneously, would there be one song that you would like to add to the playlist?
Oh, that's hard. Just one?
Everybody says that.
Oh, I know.
Two is also okay. No.
Two is okay. Yeah. Yes. So I think one that is just beautiful that everyone should try to get a hold of is Praxis for 12 by Yanni Christo, a Greek composer who died too early. Changed my life listening to this piece. I think the second one is Videotape by Radiohead.
Okay, will be added to the playlist shortly. Yeah. Great. Last question. I mean, especially you are doing so many projects at a time, and you know, you're using checklists and notes, et cetera. But there is the moment at the end of the day, everybody needs to, you know, have some rest and maybe calm down, because otherwise you're getting crazy. We were talking about that. Is there maybe some kind of ritual or something you are using to get your head some kind of empty from the day's stuff to have a bit of relaxation?
Yeah, I think the one thing I try to do is, and I did this more in Los Angeles, but go to a concert every evening. Go to an art gallery if you can. Do something that inspires your practice in a way that isn't requiring you to do this, that may have some inspiration on a different level. And I always find it the most inspiring to go and see my friends perform. And like, they do everything from pop to jazz to classical. And I'm just always so inspired by them to go to all of these places and say, like, that's my friend up there. That's my friend. I'm so proud. I'm so lucky to be a part of their life. Get out, expose yourself, you know? And that's the most calming thing, because then I feel rejuvenated for the day.
David, again, thanks a lot,
Max,
for your days in Köthen, and safe travels back home, of course, also. Hoping to see you soon and to have you maybe again as a guest in a few years in the podcast. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Ja, das war's auch schon wieder. Ich hoffe, euch hat der Talk mit David gefallen. Mich würde interessieren, ob einige von euch, die den Podcast hören, vielleicht auch schon über Musik geschrieben haben und wie eure ersten Schritte in diesem Feld so waren. Habt ihr euch da sofort wohlgefühlt oder habt ihr vielleicht irgendwelche theoretischen Bücher gelesen, um euch darauf vorzubereiten, den Gedanken über gewisse Musikstücke oder eine Art zu spielen in Worte zu fassen? Wenn ihr dazu irgendwas zu sagen habt, freue ich mich über Kommentare unter den Insta-Post oder auch über Direct Messages bei Instagram. Schaut außerdem gerne mal bei Facebook rein. Seit kurzem gibt es eine eigene Facebook-Seite für Weitesfeld, der Podcast, die ja natürlich längst überfällig war, wie mir schon viele geschrieben haben. Und ich habe jetzt auch einen YouTube-Channel eröffnet, sodass ich alle Talks auch als Video nochmal posten kann, sodass wirklich jeder, der vielleicht auch auf keiner der genannten Plattformen angemeldet ist, den Podcast hören kann. Ich freue mich schon auf die nächsten Talks und wünsche euch bis dahin eine gute Zeit. Bis dann. Ciao.